On Thursday, February 10th, 2022, Northwestern Political Union hosted 2020 presidential candidate Marianne Williamson for a conversation at Lutkin Hall. Williamson is a New York Times bestselling author and political activist. Reporters Nick Song and Helen Bradshaw spoke with her ahead of the political union event, covering topics such as war, ideology, and higher education.
Okay, so to begin, you've said before that your father took you to Vietnam as a child to see the realities of war and really introduce you to that. What do you remember when you went there? What do you remember seeing and feeling, and how did that impact you?
When I was in the seventh grade, I came home from dinner one night and I said that my teacher had taught us the domino theory. And that was the idea that if we didn't fight in Vietnam, if we didn't fight the communists in Vietnam and stop it there, then all of Southeast Asia would be overrun and one day we would be fighting on the shores of Hawaii. And my father jumped up and said, Sophie Ann, or sweetheart, as he often called her, get the visas, we're going to Saigon. And he started his rant about how the military-industrial complex was not going to eat his children's brains. My parents were international travelers. And not only did we go to Vietnam, but I traveled many, many places, starting when I was 10 years old. My father used to always say that people would say to him, why are you taking your kids all around the world? They'll never remember. And he used to say, these things will get under their skin. And it's really true. I'm a different person, I think, than I would have been had I not only traveled to all those places, but particularly as a child. You know, Americans do tend to be very under-traveled. And as a consequence, we are vulnerable to propaganda that I don't think people in other places are as vulnerable to, because other countries are close. Other countries aren't some distant, far-off land. I mean, obviously, we have Canada and Mexico, but just having Canada and Mexico on your northern and southern border does not of itself give you a large sense of the global community.
For sure. And, you know, I guess we're wondering, obviously going to Vietnam at any point in history is going to change how you view the U.S. What was it like going back to, you said you were in the seventh grade, so going back to middle school or high school in the U.S. after seeing the realities of war, as you put it?
Well, on one hand, you knew fewer people at that time, a kid growing up in school, who was likely to have traveled on their summer vacations as we did. But on the other hand, in a weird way, it was a more open society in those days. People didn't jump to conclusions about where you had been and what you had done, because people didn't jump to conclusions about every little thing the way they do today. So I think people at that time were like, oh, wow, tell us what it was like. You know, this was 1965. We were just at the beginning of what would become the gargantuan anti-war protest movement of that time. I was 15. Was I 15? No, I was 13. By the time I was 16, 17, 18, 19, full-on anti-war protests, et cetera, which I think I would have been part of even if I had not made that journey. I think the larger point for me is that that trip was indicative of my father's sensibility in the home I grew up in, which was not only very international in perspective, but also in all ways emphatic that the human experiences of people mattered and must always be considered behind the mask of official political propaganda, whether it was people in the other side of the world or on the other side of town. My father was an immigration lawyer. So I grew up in a home of profound humanitarian sensibility. And, you know, I think I tweeted the other day, my father used to wake up in the morning, he'd walk around the house, beat the system, kids, beat the system, beat the system, kids. And I think I was 50 years old before I realized how not kidding my father was. He had grown up in poverty. You know, a lot of people in his generation did, because they'd been through the Depression. He grew up in real poverty. And I remember sometimes we would be somewhere and he would point out someone, a janitor, someone cleaning up an office building, someone we saw on a corner, and he would make us stop. He'd say, see that kid, see that woman or see that man? And he'd say, she has a hard life. Or he has a hard life. He did not want us to not notice. There is a play that was written by Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman. And one of the famous lines is when Linda, Willie Loman's wife, says to her sons about their father, attention must be paid. You must always pay attention to what human beings are going through. That's what I got from my father and my mother, because my mother executed the vision, you know?
Yeah.
He was railing in his armchair. You know, she was the one making it all happen.
Definitely. And speaking of theater, when you were 17, 18, you decided to go to Pomona College mm-hmm. and study theater. I was wondering what brought you
there.
And philosophy. I was wondering what brought you there to Pomona to begin with, as well as the decision to actually study.
I look back on that because my choices at the time were that or Brandeis University. And I wonder how my life might have unfolded differently with certain educational choices. I left college when I was in my junior year and then went to classes at University of Texas and University of New Mexico, but I never graduated. But I think that in a weird way, you know, I'm at an age where you know, I read a book once where it was a German writer, I can't remember her name. She said, in youth you learn, in age you understand. And I think that I have learned as much from my successes as from my failures. And I've learned as much from things, I've learned from everything. I think the only failure in life is what you fail to learn from. And I grew up how can I put this? My not graduating from college, and I'm certainly not bragging about it, and I'm certainly not suggesting it. So kids, stay in school. I experienced a level of outcast, a level of feeling a failure that I don't think I would have otherwise experienced.
This is because you didn't graduate from college
because
or while
I didn't
you were at
graduate.
College?
Because I did. I mean, you know, I think sometimes what would have happened if I had finished school, I probably would have gone to law school. My father was a lawyer. My brother is a lawyer. I think about what my life would have been, but I don't think I would have had the career that I have had. But once again, that's not in any way to say that's a reason to drop out of college, guys. I'm just saying I realized some things happened in my life because I fell off the bridge, because I fell out of something. I realize that, you know, there's a saying in religion, there is no spot where God is not. Wherever we are, there are things to be learned and things to be gained.
Did you notice going to college, or even just in those years, not even being in college, you know, you say your father really shaped your ideology in many ways. Did you notice any points where you had experiences or you learned and you began to deviate from that ideology at all? Like you found new ways of thinking that you hadn't been taught?
Well, remember, I graduated from high school in 1970. So the tumult of the counterculture at that time, the sexual revolution, the musical revolution, the political revolution, the entirety of the counterculture went against the grain of my parents' model. I was supposed to wage revolution, but wear white kid gloves while doing so. Make sure your hair is brushed. So as much as I remained aligned with my parents' politics, I think they were pretty appalled by the countercultural wildness that I embraced. But that was, you know, because my parents, they came from a very left-wing perspective, but not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So that's where that clash occurred in my family, as it occurred for millions of people. My parents were not Woodstockian, you know. But I think every person has their own sort of divine curriculum in life. Every generation has its own wisdom. You individuate from your parents. I did from mine, just as you have and are from yours. You know, your parents, and as my daughter has from me, your parents set you up, and then you fly. As you know, you fly out of that nest, and you forge your own path in life. When I was in school, my major was theater and philosophy. So I was always very interested in religious and spiritual and philosophical topics, whether they were esoteric or exoteric, whether it was Kierkegaard and Heidegger, or it was the I Ching and the tarot cards. But I never understood how I could build a career doing that. And that was very upsetting to my parents. And at that time, what were your choices? You could study comparative religion, which I did in school when I was there. I could try to get a degree and maybe be a college professor in comparative religion, or become clergy. You know what? I could, you know, my mother used to say, your father and I will send you to rabbinical school. But I was very interested in something that didn't at that time, and I think the world is sort of different now, but my interest, for instance, when I started reading A Course in Miracles, there was no
career. And this was in college?
That would have been after, because that would have been in my mid-20s. There wasn't a career niche for people who were teaching and writing about non-denominational spiritual topics. So I just kind of was a wanderer, no different than many people my age and time, but I now look at that time as having been more fertile than I could have realized at the time.
So, you know, based on your education and your life perspective, you've been very outspoken about your desire to suspend student loan debt. Is there any specific experiences that have shaped that stance that you can think of?
Yes. When I was young, you could afford to be poor. Yes. That's what drives me insane. You know, I heard, and by that, don't misunderstand me, because I'm not glib about the word poor there. You're in your 20s, you're hanging out, you're working as a barista, or you're scooping soup, or being a waiter or waitress, you are, you know, just kind of being young and reading all the time and doing those kinds of jobs. But you could live. I see people now, the kinds of jobs that I did in my 20s, I could live in an apartment. I could afford an apartment. I see people now, you know, I was looking at a video just yesterday, the president, he said, you know, I hear young people say, we have it so hard. Hey, did you see that video? He said, young people say they have it so hard. I say, give me a break. We had it hard. And you know what we did? We went out and changed the world. And I thought, wow, the system was not as locked up then. You could be in your 20s and kind of not know what you were going to do with your life. And it was cool. You'd figure it out. But today, between crushing college loan debt, and, you know, I had parents who would send me to school. I see so many people today who are in the exact same situation I was in, but they're crushed by circumstances I wasn't crushed by. And so, no, it's not the same. Young people today are carrying, you know, we had serious problems. We had serious problems with the civil rights movement was in response to, that was the anti-war movement was in response to. I mean, we were, you know, against the war machine. We were definitely trying to change the world, but we had a sense that it was possible. And if things went wrong, the risk was not global annihilation.
So,
I felt, despite it all, that not only my own family, but my country, despite it all, wanted me to succeed. I felt like I had messed up. Okay, I dropped out of school. Well, I kept expecting, well, I'll go back, you know, because I would take classes at University of Mexico. Another, I'd take classes at University of Texas. I just expected I'd go back and finish my degree, and then it just sort of never happened. But I felt supported. I think we were supported in those days. You could have lost years. You'd find yourself. I see young people today who, they have concerns and worries that you shouldn't have to have in the richest country in the world.
We've spent a lot of time talking about your platform of getting rid of student debt, things like this, things that you ran on in 2020. Do you plan to run in 2024?
I don't know. I think that I'm holding in my heart what everybody I know is holding, what I assume you're holding, what any conscious person is holding. And that's the realization we're in trouble in this country today. And I think we're all being called as a generation. And when I say as a generation, I mean all of us who are adults. You know, there's the generation which is your generation as opposed to my generation. And then there's a generation in which we are all the adult generation in America at this time. And I am someone, as I'm sure you are as well, asking, you know, in the deepest way possible and to the best of my ability, what part can I best play? You want to be of greatest service and you don't want to be in the way. And then, you know, that's a needle that you're threading, right? So I think this year is one of soul searching for me, as it is for anybody with a brain right now.
Speaking of service, you know, I'm from Santa Monica, like in the California's 33rd congressional, when you ran in 2014. I'm wondering, like, how your educational history and everything you said about going all the way back to your father to, you know, this divergent college path, did that compel you to run for office?
Are you asking me if my own educational journey contributed to my wanting to run for office? I mean, I'm a little confused.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I guess, you know, we were looking
you
at.
You know, by the time, I know it's kind of hard for you to imagine this now, but in 20 years, your educational foundation is not going to be front and center in your mind. What you learned in your education is going to be front and center in your mind. What you learned in life is going to be front and center of your mind. But your formal education, like being at Northwestern, is just going to be one factor in the larger picture. I mean, you're just starting out, you know, your relationships, your romantic relationships, your everything that's going on in your life, it's bigger. You know, your educational foundation is core, but it's not the totality. I do think that my running for office, it was not rooted at that point in any of that. It, except in so far as what I mentioned earlier, that I feel it actually contributed to my sort of identification with those who feel lost. The fact that I felt lost for a while. But by the time I ran for office, I already had a well-established career. Because remember, I found my calling. I had found my calling. And so I had found my calling. I'd found my work. I found what felt like my dharma. And I was, in fact, you talk about being from Santa Monica. I started lecturing at the time when the AIDS crisis exploded on the scene. And so I had a career and had a career for decades up close and personal, that put me very up close and personal with people whose lives were in crisis. And what I began to realize about 20 years ago is that too many people's lives were in crisis, not through some act that came out of the blue, like AIDS or cancer, but rather because of bad public policy. My father used to say, injustice, a sense of injustice. That I think I got from my father, a sense of injustice, that it's wrong. It's wrong for people to wake up in the morning and work hard 40 hours a week and not be able to make a living and be able to rent an apartment, and that's the situation of half the people in America, that 18 million Americans, one in four Americans, cannot afford the prescription drugs that have been prescribed to them by their doctors, that 500,000 people, over 500,000 people, are homeless in this country. The 2 million children a year are homeless. I don't care if you've had an education or not. If you have a heart, you look at that and you go, something is really wrong. Something is really wrong. This is not about your educational resume. This is about your consciousness. And those things are not going to be made right unless we make them right, because there are gargantuan establishment and corporate forces that resist the unrigging of our system.
I want to circle back to an idea we were talking about earlier, just to wrap up. But you were talking about how your own ideas deviated from your parents and how you grew into those ideas and learned through your own experience. I come from a very rural community, kind of in the middle of nowhere, Florida, and there's what it seems like are a lot of bubbles of kids who grow up believing that their parents' reality is the reality, and it's not until they go out in the world, and sometimes that's college, sometimes that's not, that they begin to have their own experiences that shape their ideology, and sometimes at a certain point that has stuck in them so long that they don't begin to branch out of that. What do you think can teach kids the true realities of the world when they're in these bubbles, when they're maybe not having those experiences? How can they form these ideologies and become enlightened, so to speak, to the harsh reality that the United States finds itself in?
Well, everybody is on their own journey. And people, it's not up to us what we learn. The issue is whether we learn through joy or through pain. And this country is going through a reckoning, and everybody's going to feel it. And changes are coming. They're either going to come because we're wise and because we tenderly make a transition to the best of our ability, a just transition to a from a war economy to a peace economy, from a dirty economy to a clean economy, from an unjust economic system to a just economic system. That change is going to happen. It's either going to happen because we get wise, or it's going to happen because certain changes are thrust upon us. I don't think it's the job or the ability of you or I to know what's going to wake up someone else. I think it's the job and the ability and the responsibility of you and me to wake up in the morning and to ask how we can help. And I know that you know, the very fact you go to Northwestern, you are by definition among the privileged. I mean, just looking at you and knowing where you are the privileged. And I also know, given the state of the world today, you know that. So I believe that the guidance as to what to do with that comes from our own hearts. And I believe in waking up every morning and asking, how can I help today? And the fact that you're, you know, given who you are, what you look like, the fact that you're Northwestern and the fact that you're studying journalism means that you are needed. And you will be guided through your own life experience and your own hearts to play the part, just like when you were asking me if I'm going to run for president. That's where all of us are. And as long as we keep our minds focused on that question, how can I help? How can my skills, how can my tools, how can my experience, how can my talents, how can whatever I am, whoever I am and whatever I have, how can that be pooled? We're all pooling our resources now. This is not a revolution that's going to be led by soloists. You know, my culture knows what they did. When you have cultural revolutions that are led by soloists, they have a way of dealing with that. This is a song. This is a choir. This is you waking up in the morning and you doing what you can do. You waking up in the morning, you can do what you do. All of us in our ethnicity, in our nationality, in our skill set. Those of us who are younger doing what that generation knows to do. Those of us who are older knowing what that generation knows to do. And then as long as we spend all of our time monitoring our own progress and doing our best, you know, Gandhi said, self-purification must precede direct political action. If we seek to purify our own hearts and be the people that the God of our understanding would have us be, and I think we'll know what to do, and I think we're going to do something extraordinary in our time.
Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I hope I get to meet you in person when I'm at Northwestern. I look forward to being there.
I hope so too. We're really excited to see you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye, guys. Thank you.
Bye.
Have a good day.